Good afternoon, everyone. If you don't have your headphones on, please put them on now, as I gather that's the only way you're going to get amplification of what we're saying. Welcome, everybody, to the event formerly known as Camp Alphaville. London's actual meteorological weather is as changeable as its political weather. Those who were here last year will probably remember it was in quite uniquely disgusting, worse than New York weather conditions such as I've never known before. The temperature got above 90, the humidity got beyond that, people were stripping to their shorts trying to survive this incredibly uncomfortable conditions. So now we're in a sort of Great British Bake Off style marquee, and of course it's raining with a good strong cross current. My apologies for the weather. Now we're going to be discussing in this panel the new nationalism. I'm not sure quite what's supposed to be new about this particular nationalism compared to the various nationalisms that have been with us for a while, but obviously in this country there is a lot of nationalism about at the moment following last week's fascinating referendum. We will try to be as informal as this event usually is. The structure, we have a fantastic panel to discuss things. The structure will involve, first of all, hearing from Anne Pettifor, facing me here, who will make a brief presentation of a paper on the new nationalism, what effects it has on the global economy, on justice and equality in the global economy. Then I will ask for responses from our discussants, Srinivas of the Jerome Levy Forecasting Centre, Tyler Cowen, best known to many of you from the Marginal Revolution blog, and Francis Coppola, another great star of social media. Then we will try to have an actual Tea Party conversation. So without further ado, I'd like to pass over to Anne Pettifor.
Thank you very much, John. Can everyone hear when I speak like, right, fine. So I want to start with Donald Trump and to remind you that he hasn't just agreed to build a physical wall between Mexico and the United States. He's also introduced the subject of capital controls. He has said it's an easy decision for Mexico. Make a one-time payment of $5 to $10 billion to pay for the wall to ensure that $24 billion continues to flow into their country every year. So that's happening in the United States, where there's walls proposed, not just physical walls for migration, but also for money. Meanwhile, in India, Mr. Subramanian Swamy has attacked the governor of the Bank of India, Raghuram Rajan, and he has said the government should have known that the inevitable consequence of rising and high interest rates and his policy was willful and thus anti-national in intent. He goes on to say that the post of governor of the Reserve Bank of India is very high in the warrant of precedence, whatever that is, and requires a patriotic and unconditional commitment to our nation. So that's happening across in India. And then here in Britain, we have, of course, Remain. Now, I want to say that I was a Remainer, but I was rather horrified with some of the company that I was obliged to keep, including that of the executive director of the Adam Smith Institute, who wrote on Facebook that he liked and respected many leavers, but he'd never shared their enthusiasm for democracy. He wants liberty and prosperity, and he doesn't want to trade that in just to give his stupid next-door neighbours more power over his life. To the extent that the EU does restrict democracy, it is often for the best, he wrote, preventing governments from doing nasty, illiberal things like restricting immigration or subsidizing domestic firms. There's a small chance, he ended on, that a Jeremy Corbyn could be elected. If he is, under the British political system, he would have basically unlimited power to do whatever he wants. The EU, he wrote, limits that power, and in my view, that's a good thing. I think Mr. Bowman gives us some explanation of why some people were very unhappy with the European Union. So how do we explain all this? Well, I'm with Brad DeLong, who in his blog this week talked about who would be taught in the social theory courses of, say, 2070, and who will end their careers in the 2070s wishing that they had used these writers when they started in the 2010s. And after mulling this question, DeLong wrote, I've narrowed down my choice to the writings of three people. Tocqueville, who wrote in the 1830s and 40s, John Maynard Keynes, who wrote in the 20s and 30s, and Karl Polanyi, who wrote in the 30s and 40s. Now, I don't know a lot about Tocqueville, but I'm a great fan of both John Maynard Keynes, and in particular his monetary theory, for which he was really most concerned, and I'm going to talk now about Karl Polanyi and how incredibly relevant Karl Polanyi's analysis is to today's circumstances. And if only we'd read Polanyi before, we would not have got ourselves into this mess. So the key concept that he has is of the double movement. As George Soros defined it, market fundamentalism is about movements that seek to detach the market from its position as embedded in society's cultural, political, and social norms and institutions, and to instead turn the market towards an autonomous and self-regulating system. The problem with every attempt to do that, to detach the market from society, is that it has destabilizing consequences which set off countervailing movements and do this systematically and without fail. And these countervailing movements are by other groups in society who recognize the need to protect themselves and others from exposure to unmediated market forces. These counter movements are just as likely to be conservative, and he writes, even populist and fascist, as market destabilizations will mobilize the right no less than the left. So in Polanyi's framework, these ongoing and polarizing conflicts are more complex than the Marxist idea of class struggle between the bourgeoisie and the proletariat. Rather, particular policy ideas create shifting constituencies of groups that favor or oppose expanding or constraining markets. And since the project of creating a self-regulating market is ultimately impossible, there will be times that even the largest businesses and banks come to mind will defect and openly embrace the use of government for protection against market turmoil. So free market ideology, I will argue, is based on ideas that are really old. I mean, dear old Malthus, Ricardo and Smith were those ones who developed these ideas of our need only to be governed by the invisible hand. And Malthus was inspired by a fellow called Joseph Townsend. In fact, he was found guilty of plagiarizing Townsend, who wrote in 1786 about the apocryphal story of goats and dogs said to have been introduced into a previously deserted island in the South Pacific by the Spanish in the 17th century. The relentless struggle for survival between the two beasts brought on by the island's scarcity eventually, he wrote, became a harmonious equilibrium. And that is what a lot of market ideology is about. Both Malthus and Ricardo asserted that only the price mechanism and other incentives built into the market economy could effectively bring supply and demand into balance and assure the optimal use of economic resources. And interesting, it's not very different from the appeal of Marxism, which sought to undermine the power and ugliness of politics and that anticipated the withering away of the state. But, argues Polanyi, in a complex society, we can't escape the necessity of politics and of governmental coordination of economic and social life. Indeed, he sees it as the only bulwark against both government and market tyranny. And the really, for me, profound aspect of Polanyi's thinking is his identification of the three fictitious commodities, money, land, and labor. He says they're false commodities because they are not produced for sale. For me, the most important of these is money, which is a social construct, as we know, and misunderstanding the nature of money and credit and thinking of it as a commodity results in flawed economic concepts such as the natural rate of interest or that money can be produced in response to the price mechanism. So the theory of market self-regulation rests on the pretense that the supply and demand for these fictitious commodities can be equilibrated by the price mechanism, just as if they were true commodities. He goes on to insist that to avoid the demolition of society, the supply and demand for these fictitious commodities in actual market societies must be managed through the political process. But market liberals want the opposite. They want to embed society in their autonomous economy, devoid of democratic political mediation oversight. That is what he regards as a stark utopia. So, and he argues that society, of course, spontaneously, never in a planned way, spontaneously, and this is what makes the Brexit vote so interesting, reacts with a counter-movement. And his critique of deregulation was that it was not deregulation. In fact, it was re-regulation of the economy, this time to embed it in a different set of social, political, and cultural relations and institutions. But these institutions and cultural relations and political relations would be this time disadvantage the poor and advantage the rich. So we don't have deregulation, we have re-regulation. And we see this most clearly in the United Kingdom, where, as Aaron Davis and Catherine Walsh have shown, there have been major changes to enable the financialization of the economy. For me, the most important one was competition and credit control in 1971, where loans would be granted to companies and individuals that could pay the highest rates rather than to those that fulfill the authority's qualitative criteria and overall conditions for lending, i.e. credit based on cost rather than years of rationing based on control. And that began the whole expansion and explosion of the financialization of the economy. In 1970-1980, we got the release of exchange and credit controls and thus initiated a new credit boom. Oh, I've lost the rest of my paper. Where is it? Sorry. I was going to list all the various regulations. You'll be grateful that I don't. The UK-based institutional investors started switching far more of their funds abroad and away from UK industry. Stamp duty on the purchase of shares and bonds was cut in stages from 2 to 0.5%. Dividend payment controls were abolished in 82. Corporation tax was cut for all businesses, but this was paid for specifically by removing capital investment allowances for machinery and plants. Value-added tax rate rises occurred on goods and services, but financial and insurance services were made VAT-exempt and are still VAT-exempt. This doubly disadvantaged industry next to finance, as the former made much greater use of real goods and services. And as a result, you will know all, you know this all, investment in financial services grew 320%, next to investment in manufacturing, which rose only at 12.8% from 1979 to 89. UK bank assets, which had been equally roughly equal to half the value of UK GDP, had risen to five times the value of GDP by the mid-2000s, and so on and so forth. All of this you know. By the time of the financial crisis in 2007-08, the UK's financial sector, relative to its economy, was bigger than any other G7 nation. In contrast, UK industry suffered a faster decline than all its economic rivals in the same period. In 1970, UK manufacturing accounted for 30% of GDP, 16% of world exports, and had trade surpluses of 4 to 6% annually. 35% of UK employment was in this sector. By 2010, 13% of GDP and 10% of total employment was in manufacturing, and the UK was running a trade deficit in excess of 2 to 4%. So what we find is that this has led naturally to the impoverishment of those who do not belong to the financial sector. You've seen them, they've grown increasingly insecure and unequal. And while they have continued to perhaps enjoy employment here in Britain, it has been pay levels have not recovered to what they were before the crisis. So they now wish to see, as the first letter in the FT this morning said correctly, they wish to see protected from Andrew Mitchell, Newcastle. They wish to see protected markets and jobs, aggressive restrictions on immigration, and an end to bankers and hedge fund millionaires living high on the hog. That populist genie will not easily be put back in the bottles, as Polanyi argued. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Andrew. Have one of those. Thank you very much for that. Anybody who tries to deny the political reality of the perception of a deep problem of the kind that Anne has just explained to us is obviously swimming against an extremely strong tide. We've just had a very clear exposition of the case against financial capitalism and against globalization, I suppose it's fair to say, as it has evolved, and I suppose an argument in favor of capital controls.
An argument in favor of managing market forces and not allowing them to be managed by the invisible hand.
Which has ultimately to involve
capital controls.
So that's our starting position. Tyler, how would you respond to that? Would you agree with the negative assessment that we've heard with the Polanyi approach, and are you prepared to countenance capital controls?
The war against globalization is very much overstated. If we look at some very basic facts, foreign direct investment today, in absolute or percentage terms, it's much higher than it's ever been before. Migration today, across borders or within large nations, much higher than ever before. And for all of the anti-immigrant sentiment, this is very unlikely to be reversed. It is likely to slow down. What we're seeing is a slowdown in globalization, a consolidation, not a reversal, not actually massive opposition. If we look at international trade, we just had a 17-year period, 1990 to 2007, you can check that in the FT, where trade grew at 3 times the rate of GDP. And yes, that slowed down. Right now, trade is growing at exactly the rate of GDP growth in the world. That is not too bad of a reversal. It's actually probably what it should be. It's a fairly normal state of affairs. Again, it represents a consolidation. I just know all of you in the room, you're obsessed with Brexit and what the next government will be. I have some advice for you. Go visit a few Chinese megacities. I was a month ago in Shandong province, which I believe has about twice the population of the United Kingdom. And the increase in resource mobility there and trade over the last 20 years has been phenomenal, dwarfing anything that has happened in Europe by orders of magnitude. Most of that will not be reversed. This is a place that had virtually no infrastructure. Cities 2 or 3 hours apart still have different cuisines. And now Shandong as a province is doing pretty well. Most of the globalization still going on is actually going on within large countries, China and India. We don't always call it globalization because legally they're single nations, but for most practical economic and sometimes legal purposes, it's just like globalization that is still going on. There is not so much of a backlash against it. It is very much elevating literally billions of human beings. There are many misconceptions about my own nation. I know all about Mr. Trump. I view him as a manifestation of white male identity politics. To me, although I'm a white male, very distasteful. If you look at polls of Americans, you simply ask them, what do you think of international trade? The overall response is more positive than it was 5 years ago. Only by a small amount, but it's up, it's not down. If you ask people, what do you think of immigrants? Do they help the United States? The overall response is slightly up, it is not down. So I think people, especially intellectuals, especially the media, they want to slot Mr. Trump into a kind of worldwide anti-globalization brigade. I don't think that's what's going on. What I think is a lot of aspects of globalization have essentially won out. There's some backlash against some of the identity consequences of those changes. For the most part, we're seeing a locking in and consolidation. The world as a whole, look at Africa, look at South America. Growth there is much slower than we'd like. But you're seeing trade relations across those countries becoming more powerful. There's talk now of introducing an all-Africa passport that will let people in different African countries migrate to each other. So the whole picture, put aside Brexit, think about the Chinese megacities, think about Uttar Pradesh in India, think about the world, the overall trend, and billions of people being lifted out of extreme poverty. It's clear. And yes, in two very tiny Anglo countries, one called United Kingdom, the other called United States, there have been some setbacks, and there is, especially in my country, the onset of some political barbarism. I hate this. It's probably not the end of the world, and Trump is very, very likely to lose because he's a terrible candidate and cannot run anything.
That's what they said about Brexit.
Let me just say two concluding points on democracy. I had lunch with Sam Bowman the other day. He's a great guy. People mean so many different things by democracy. I'll tell you what's a bad kind of democracy. Deciding a constitutional level issue with a referendum with a 50% threshold.
of those who voted, not of the total electorate as well, yes.
If that's democracy, none of us should be for it, right? So big terms like that aren't that helpful. Financialization, the banking sector, why is it so large? There's a very simple hypothesis. The more peaceful the world, the more wealth accumulates. There's a lot of evidence finance is a roughly constant 2% of wealth, right? Now, as the ratio of wealth to income grows, the financial sector does become a larger part of GDP. That is a regulatory problem. I'm not saying we should do nothing, but it's actually a pretty natural development in a peaceful world that finance as a constant share of wealth will be a rising part of GDP. There are some problems. We haven't fully addressed them. I'm not sure we ever will, but it's nothing especially sinister. It's a regulatory problem which we will manage. Capital controls, no, I don't want them. They're less popular in the world as a whole today, actually, than they ever have been. That's for good reason. No one else in the U.S. is running on the notion of restricting Mexican remittances. In fact, if Mexicans send money back home, it's a kind of mercantilist policy. It weakens the U.S. dollar, stimulates our exports. If Trump thought about it for a moment, well, he still wouldn't realize that. Anyway, be a little suspicious of media framing. Look at the big picture. Look at the numbers. There are some real setbacks. I'm not saying be complacent, but things aren't nearly as bad or nearly as anti-global as you're being told. Thank you.
I guess that's a bit. A good and fair immediate riposte. It still occurs to me when we're starting to look at the second order derivatives, the rate of change or the rate of improvement in trade, that's cause for concern, if you like, globalization. Let's move on to Srinivas.
I'm probably somewhere in between Tyler and Anne.
There's a fair amount of space.
I know, there is a fair amount of space.
Let's locate.
I do find it very troubling that people who are willing to be so, the wisdom of the markets, so they believe in the wisdom of the markets, they believe in the people when people are making market decisions, but are disdainful of them, are afraid of them when people are making the same decisions in a democracy. Why don't we believe in the wisdom of the markets? Why do we want to control it? And by the same token, if you do want to put checks and balances on democracy, which I am for, you also need to be cognizant and be supportive of checks and balances on the market, which is what Anne is calling for. And I come from India, where we practice untrammeled democracy. Time and again, people vote for people, with most middle class and elite people find it very, very confounding. But thank God we have that. We haven't had a famine in the 60 years that we have been there. Famines that used to be very recurrent in the 200 years before that, where millions of people used to die. So democracy does put checks and balances on the elite. And I find it very troubling when people speak against democracy. The second thing is the disdain that I find among the people who say, oh, these people are either racist or xenophobes, or that if that is your answer, I'm sorry. You are very not smart, in my view. You have not done your analysis well, if that is your answer. There is studies which by people from very mainstream economists who have shown that trade, especially with China, has had very damaging consequences for certain segments of the American population. And these are the states where Trump is actually having a huge amount of success, the industrial rust belt. So these are not the traditional old South people. He did win in the South as well, but that's not, he's just, you cannot put it down just to xenophobia and a crisis in the white male identity. I know it's easy to bash white males. I'm not one, but it is easy to bash them. But I do not think that's just the answer here. That said, I do think that globalization, I take my own country, India, although I've been living in the U.S. for the last 20 years, tremendous progress in the last 25 years. There is no question, there is a huge change in the attitude of people. I grew up at a time when we had controls on everything, including sugar, price of sugar, price of cement, and everything. And we used to stand in lines to get sugar. So from that time to the current generation, there is a massive improvement in living standards and in attitudes. People are optimistic. And that's a huge change, and I'm sure the same changes have occurred in China as well. So, but what is important here is if we want to keep these gains and we want to make sure that these gains are not lost, we have to address the real concerns of people. And we have to find a way to address those concerns and not brush them away. And I what I see is not a real desire to address those concerns. That's what scares me.
Can I just ask one follow-up? How much sands does that then mean you're prepared to throw in the gears of international capitalism? Are you, we've gone from being prepared to countenance capital controls to very strongly suggesting not, which are both logical positions. Where do you come between those?
You know, in the whole of economic theory, especially, like, even if I'm just confining myself to mainstream, leaving aside the heterodox ones, capital controls is one of, capital flows is one of the things for which there is very little empirical support that capital controls are actually beneficial. And even theoretically, it's not as solid. Recent work by Ellen Ray has shown, that you cannot, there is a policy dilemma. You cannot have free capital mobility and domestic monetary policy. So that's something that I am willing to countenance some putting gears in the sand. Clearly, free trade is less of a, there is much, much stronger case for free trade. What is not there a strong case for is that you do need to make the compensatory, the government policy has to be compensatory for the losers, which it has not been, unfortunately. But free capital flows, certainly we would want to consider that at least.
Okay. Francis, we've now staked out three very distinct positions. Can you find a fourth?
It's interesting you mentioned Ellen Ray, because I was going to channel the same thing. That although, Tyler, you talk glowingly about the benefits of globalization, and I have to agree with your statistics, globalization has been marvelous for people in developing countries. It has lifted millions, if not billions, out of poverty. That is absolutely true. But if you are somebody in the Midlands or the north of England whose industry was systematically destroyed in the 1980s and which is whose community has never recovered from that, you don't give a stuff about the improvement of people's lifestyles in China. You're interested in what's happened to your community locally. And that, I think, is the tension that we're seeing at the moment between, on the one hand, this marvelous improvement generally in global GDP and global well-being versus the concerns of, at the local level of individual people's lives. And we're struggling to find a way of reconciling those. One of the big problems, I think, is the facts versus emotion thing that we saw in the referendum, where it didn't matter what facts you threw at people, they didn't resonate, they didn't listen, because it didn't address their issues, their concerns, and what they were experiencing. I think it's therefore quite difficult to say, oh, well, the solution is to end globalization, because if you start saying, no, we need capital controls, we need to return to the much slower moving world of the past, to close down this wonderful movement of money and people and trade that we've had for we've been developing for the last 30 or 40 or so years, then we are to some extent entrenching the present situation. We are setting in stone the relative wealth of the West compared to the relative poverty of the rest of the world. And I don't think, ultimately, that that is sustainable. Had that said, the problem really is, I think, much more local than that. That what has happened with globalization is that we have seen widening inequality within countries. We've reduced inequality between countries, and that, I think, we want to keep. The problem is the widening inequality within countries, because that is where the forces for revolt, for nationalism, for the ending of the global market, if you like, are coming from. They're basically saying it's not fair, we are losing out. And it seems to me that at individual country level, and I'm not going to say specific countries, there are some obvious candidates, need to be doing something to address the massive levels of inequality within their own backyard, rather than complaining about what's going on somewhere else. So for me, and I do want to talk a little bit about what's happened in the UK now, because I think this is really important. What we're seeing here is the return of the locus of identity back to the nation state. And I think that is not just happening in the UK, it's happening generally, that rather than these sort of big conglomerations and the idea of the world as one market and one nation and one happy family, we're seeing that fragmenting much more down to local levels and to national loyalties as an identity. And if I can quote you something that somebody said to me, and we're talking about, he was talking about Oldham, where he grew up, and saying, he said, the problem is that after the industries, the mills, the mining communities of that area were destroyed in order to break the unions, he said, these people saw their industries sold to foreigners, they saw their utilities sold to foreigners, they saw their public services split up and sold to foreigners, they saw their jobs going to foreigners, they saw the place overrun with flipping foreigners, and now they want to shut the door on them. Now, that's a harsh thing to say. It sounds horrible, doesn't it? But ultimately, that's, I think, where a lot of the fear and a lot of the return to nationalist politics is coming from, and not just in the UK, but in other places as well, which is why I'm highlighting this, not as a particularly British phenomenon, it's happening all over the place, that there is this sense of losing identity, losing community, losing stability, losing security, as Anne said. And it seems to me, again, this is back to local and national governments and how they deal with the divides within their own societies. It is not a matter of saying we have a choice between globalization and nationalism. We don't. That's so where I would leave it.
Just one follow-up on that. So in some ways you're saying that it's the freedom of movement of people, of labor, that aspect of globalization, which is creating the real fissures, the real concerns and ratcheting up inequality, all the various other complaints that we're making, more so than the freedom of movement of capital and of money?
I think that the freedom of movement of people is certainly emotionally more difficult for a lot of people. I think they see it in a way that they don't see the free movement of capital. So they, whereas the free movement of capital, they're angry about that because of the consequences. Because, you know, we did have very unstable large capital flows, which have caused crises, and that is one of the problems of very large movements of capital that happen very fast. Is they have ripple effects over the whole economy. We know that, and actually we have been putting in place some degree of control over those, some means of controlling market forces so we don't have awful crashes. That is something we have been doing over the last 5 or 6 years. But I think at the local level, it is people are much more concerned. They see the effects of the movement of people more. I don't myself have a problem with immigration at all. I'm just simply saying that that is what I'm here seeing, is people feeling swamped, shall we say.
Why don't you respond to everything we've heard, and then I'll try asking a few questions.
Thank you, John, and thank you, everyone, for the responses. Tyler, I want to say to you, the point about democracy and about referendum, I don't like referendum. I think this one was an extraordinarily irresponsible referendum, and I find it unforgivable that our government would have done that. However, what is fascinating from the British point of view is that in our general elections, people in the northeast, who probably amongst the most badly damaged by austerity, actually, because it wasn't just the instability in the financial crisis, it was the fact that our government chose to punish large sections of the population who were innocent of the crisis. And in the northeast, that's where it's most—that's most obvious. In a general election, the voices of the north people of the northeast is not heard because the way our system works and is rigged, if you like, is that it's swing voters who really determine our election outcomes. And the swing voters tend to be in middle-class constituencies in Middle England. What's happened with this referendum is that 17 million people whose voices are not normally represented and expressed in the outcome of elections, though of course they all vote in elections, is that those voices were heard. So this is what's different about this referendum.
And there could be US analogues with gerrymandered House seats and with the Electoral College at the presidential level.
I know not enough about that, yes. Okay. But my second point is that Polanyi was very aware of the dynamism of markets and of how successful they can be in improving living standards. So it's not an opposition to markets per se. It's an opposition to the idea that markets can be disembedded from the real economy, that they can operate autonomously and independently of regulatory, democratic regulatory oversight. And I, too, want to see free trade. I'm not one for closing down globalization. In fact, what I want is a restoration of the golden age, 1945 till 1971, when we had the Bretton Woods system, and trade, finance, and immigration was managed. It wasn't closed down. It wasn't nationalized. The design of the Bretton Woods was designed to deal with the reaction, the Polanyian reaction of the 1930s, when people rose up as a countervailing force to this market liberalism, and then became quite irrational and went for nationalism, fascism, anything, any strong man or woman who would protect them from the forces of the market. And this is what we're seeing now. We're seeing Mrs. Le Pen, we're seeing Donald Trump, we're seeing people here, we're seeing Mr. Farage. And of course, we're across the board. These are people promising, I think terribly wrongly and irrationally, to protect people from the market forces. So can I just say that what happened, and I read Ed Conway's wonderful history of the Bretton Woods Conference the other day, and I hadn't realized this before, but Roosevelt forbade any banker from attending the Bretton Woods Conference. Right.
I didn't know that one.
In fact, there was one who was one of there was one guy who was from Chicago who was a mate of Roosevelt's who was allowed to come, but he wasn't allowed to say anything. So the finance sector was just absent from the reconstruction of the financial architecture post the devastating crisis of the 1930s depression and a world war. They built an architecture which gave us the golden age in economics. Even orthodox economists referred to the period as the golden age, when you didn't control, but you managed. You didn't allow things simply to become chaotic and anarchic and without any sense of management in the interests of democratic constituencies. So I'm not asking for a clamp. I'm not a nationalist. I'm not a fascist. I don't want to see borders going. I don't want to see the irrational reaction of protectionism that is a result of this market fundamentalism. In order to moderate that reaction, we need to moderate market fundamentalism.
Okay, thank you very much. Go ahead, Francis, and then Taylor, I think.
Yes, I just wanted to pick up on something that Anne said about control, because, again, one of the things that we keep hearing is this, people say, it was even the slogan of Brexit was take back control. Yeah. And this is what I'm hearing a lot of the time about people feeling that they're losing control of their lives. That when we go for, we've tried for 30 or 40 years to separate economics from politics, but it is through politics that people feel they actually achieve some degree of control. And I don't mean the kind of the global politics or the international and trade agreements or the sort of distant political elites. I'm really talking about local politics. And increasingly, that actually has been systematically dismantled, and not just in the UK. That increasingly, the power is seen as being at much more sort of elevated levels, and there is this sense of people just losing control of their lives. And it's interesting you're talking about control, because this isn't just a question of saying we need to have control of market forces. I think it's also about saying, is it, how do we restore back to people the sense of having some control over their own destinies? Because it seems to me that that's what's underlying this, and that's what the resurgence of local identity intensive nationalist politics is really coming from, I think.
Now, Taylor, could we move on? Be very interested to hear how you feel about the golden age of Bretton Woods. I'll make one cynical point myself about that, is that it was a golden age for the, and Bretton Woods was an agreement for the less than a third of the world that wasn't either communist or in driving poverty for that quarter of a century.
That's not true about Africa, for example, where I'm from.
Right.
You know, growth in Africa in that period was much higher than in the liberalisation period. Yeah. Africa's been through a period of degrowth, which in any other country would have led to revolution.
Right.
And instead, you know, was tolerated as IMF policy. So and it's not true that it was all the time, the case. But there was about communism.
I stand corrected, but it wasn't a great era of growth for the communist world. Anyway.
Bretton Woods had to end when it did. You couldn't bring it back. Let me just say a few things about my own country, a few facts. President Obama has an approval rate of 52-53%, remarkably high for a second-term president. This is not hatred of the system. There's not one member of Congress running on the Trump platform, not one. Most of them don't want to speak at the convention. The average income of a Trump voter in the primaries was $71,000. I'm not saying none of these people were economically motivated, but it's not mostly about broken Appalachia, $71,000. The biggest shock of this whole discussion, no one has mentioned morals and religion. We live in an unprecedentedly secular age, and in some ways, much to our detriment, and the United Kingdom is one of the most secular countries in the world.
Very much so.
If you look at Utah in the United States, which is about half Mormon, the middle class there is thriving and doing well. It's not because of the profile of the Utah economy. It's because they are religious. If you do some very simple regressions and simply look at people who do not drink and who do not take drugs and how have they fared over the last 20 years, you will see a very, very different story. And it is impolitic to say this, but a lot of our problems stem from the decline of religion in American and also British life. And I say that as a non-religious person, but I believe that's very much the truth.
Well, and the rise of the opiate of the masses these days is indeed an opiate. It's heroin in the US. And you can see those as substitutes for each other in many ways, I fear. Srinivas, do you have something?
Yeah, I mean, on freedom of movement of people, you know, we are all in some ways beneficiaries of movement of people. I certainly am. And there is a but here, unfortunately. You know, the studies have shown by Acemoglu and others that, generally speaking, it is harder to get consensus in a democracy for welfare or for social policies in multi-ethnic democracies. Because people generally don't tend to support things which are giveaways to other outgroups. Now, we can wish away those people, but they are human beings. And then how different are we from the communists who wished away natural human instincts? That is what it is. That's how human beings are. So some time out or some moderation of immigration would certainly help those social policies, which would then lead to the benefits of free trade being more, benefits of globalization being shared more equally, which would then make the system more stable. Ultimately, like Keynes, I think that we want to preserve the system. But how do we preserve the system? I mean, today it's fashionable to, especially among the Chicago variety, to castigate Keynes. But if those people were in charge, we would be living under communism today. That's the real problem. Keynes, the elitist, I mean, all sorts of things without really understanding the history of the situation, the context. And that's what I feel really about these things is some sort of management in a smart way to preserve the system is essential here.
Okay, thanks. I would like to ask our panelists one further question, and then I'll open up to see if anybody in the audience, for whom many thanks for putting up with quite a bit of physical discomfort to follow this, I'll open it to the audience. The one question I have is I wonder, listening to people talk, whether we're in fact, when it comes to the impact, the success, the importance of globalization, whether we're ultimately really talking in a very about China and to a lesser extent India. China has had this huge change, which in many ways maps onto what the US did during the Gilded Age. It's built itself up in a way that's a model that's been followed very successfully by various other emerging countries. That has created great difficulty for the rest of the world, particularly in the dispossessed places where Trump appears to be gaining in popularity. Trump, incidentally, it's fascinating if you look on the social media, people are beginning to pick up one of the words he uses most common, if you look at word clouds and so on, is China. He talks about China all the time. It's very central. If China actually makes the next stage of its transition, starts paying its workers more so that they don't compete so directly with people in the rest of the world, starts buying things more from everybody else so that they can raise their standard of living, becomes more of an internal market driven by consumption, all the things that we all know they want to do, That presumably makes the impact of globalization much more positive for the rest of the world. But of course, many of us very reasonably are very worried about whether the Chinese can do that. India is a few years behind China in the process, but obviously these days an even bigger country,
right,
population, similar issues there. Are we in some respects, when we're talking about the impact of globalization, really talking about that other great debate that is going on elsewhere here today about can China pull off its great transition without some horrible crisis? Bearing in mind that the US, which did something very similar in the late 19th century, had a crisis every 5 or 6 years because they didn't try to control their economy in the way the Chinese do. And then,
John, thank you for that. I have a different view of what's happening, actually. For me, China bailed out the global economy post-crisis.
Completely agree with that.
Was it 600 billion, whatever it was, the level
more
of investment?
800, I think.
Massive investment. Yeah. And it did a bit what Japan had done in 1989, actually, or in the run-up to 89, when the bond market crisis of the 1980s required Japan to lower interest rates to 1% or something and to stimulate. And as a result, thanks to the carry trade, banks were able to borrow at 1% and lend at 3% in the States and clean up their balance sheets. So China did what Japan had done then in 2007-09. And that massively expanded production and employment in China was jolly good. And China has, there's no doubt, done very well out of free market policies and lifted hundreds of millions of people out of poverty, which is wonderful. However, post-crisis, she decided on this massive expansionary policy. And the response of the West is to impose austerity. The response of Europe, Britain, and to an extent the United States, Congress will not, and Obama might be popular, but he's had a real hard time getting any real meaningful expansion out of Congress. So at this moment, the West decides to contract economic activity, and all of this production coming out of China is now dumped on these markets. And China, then Jack Liu goes to China and blames her for overproduction. But actually what had happened was that this isn't a reaction, and it was, I think, China trying to play a... I think, and if China begins to feel resentful towards the West and starts to get picky about islands in the South Pacific, in the Pacific Islands, in the South China Seas, then I really don't think we should be surprised at the rise in tensions that this is causing. Because we don't have, and this is again thanks to free market fundamentalism, we don't have international coordination and cooperation. What happened and what was absolutely a requirement of Bretton Woods was that the G7, the G8, the G20 had to talk to each other and had to cooperate to stabilize the global economy. Now, they have all these G7, G8 summits and nothing comes out of them. And it's certainly, there's nothing coordinated comes out of it. So China doesn't have a partner in trying to manage the post-crisis recovery. Indeed, what she has is someone that's working against her in her efforts to stabilize the global economy.
So I was wondering whether when we worried about globalization, we were in fact worried about China. The suggestion now is that perhaps what we're really worried about is misplaced austerity in the West. Tyler?
The negative effects of austerity are much overplayed in my view. There's such a thing as catch-up growth. A lot of the countries which cut their spending back more quickly than maybe they should have, they've caught up more quickly. You see this with Ireland. You actually saw it with the United Kingdom. It feels more painful in the short run. That, in fact, may be a mistake. But in terms of the medium run, it probably doesn't matter. My view on China is right now they are at best growing at 4%. I'm not sure within our lifetimes they'll ever grow at more than 4%. That aspect of globalization has very much slowed down, probably forever. The big story about China is the growth of national brands within China, the connecting of different regions, which used to focus as pretty much separate economic entities. The globalization of China today is within China, and it's pretty much invisible, and it's a huge force. It's one of the most important trends in the world. You could say the same about India, very hard to measure. It's extremely significant, a bigger story than most of what we worry about, and it is mostly succeeding. It's going pretty well.
Is there any of us? Sorry, that's...
Yeah, so India. China, whether can it manage a transition without a problem? depends on what you define by a problem. Let's take Japan, right?
I mean, it has managed.
Yeah, I mean, so Japan has managed without a major financial crisis, major dislocation. Unemployment never really went above 6% meaningfully. So they have managed a transition for 20 years. Maybe China can. But if, let's be clear, I mean, can we manage a transition without any financial crisis but growing robustly? I don't think that's possible. And you know, I do think that the second point about austerity, you know, see, here is the problem. There are two aspects to austerity. One is, can we do austerity in a world? Can a small country like Ireland do austerity? Yes, surely it can. But can the world as a whole grow its way out by doing austerity? Absolutely not. It's not. It's simply against balance sheet physics. It's just not possible.
Keynes's paradox.
Yeah, it's just not possible.
Yes, right.
That's number one. I mean, in fact, all those studies on expansionary austerities have been comprehensively debunked, or they were shown to be in periods in which they could export their way out of trouble, or they were periods in which the private sector was able to re-leverage because they were coming off low levels of leverage and interest rates fell a hell of a lot. None of those conditions apply today. That said, there are also the political optics of austerity. Most people don't see it that way. Here's what happened in the United States. In 2008, when TARP failed, we heard from everybody that, we need to pass this, which is a correct thing to do in my view. We can't let the banking system fail. We can't push the country towards a Great Depression. We needed to do that. But 6 months later, when they were talking about stimulus policies, this very same people, I'm not talking about the Tea Party people, I'm not talking about the unwashed masses, I'm talking about the elites, were suddenly saying, oh no, we can't do this, the government deficit, and you know, you had that terrible paper by Rogoff and Reinhoff, which is an enormous damage globally. And I do think there needs to be some recognition of those things.
Francis?
I think there's a terrible tendency to blame China for everything, and I don't buy it. I really don't. I keep coming back to the same thing. This is to do with the policies that governments choose to do themselves. It's not to do with what's going on over there. It's to do with what's going on here. So if you have a government that bails out its banks and then to pay for it, imposes that cost on its population, ultimately, eventually, there will be a backlash. And we are seeing that. And what could we think about the economics of it, and Tyler, you may be right that those countries that, Ireland imposed austerity, the UK imposed austerity, actually the country that imposed the most austerity was actually Latvia.
Exported its people.
It exported its people, but it also allowed in a lot of foreign banks to lend to its people, and that's actually what brought it back to recovery again was the Euro-Krona Gary trade. You know, we don't talk about that kind of effect, do we? You have to look beyond what you're at and look at it case by case. But what I'm saying is that it's all about what you do at an individual government level. You can't generalise, and you certainly can't say that under certain circumstances austerity is necessary. But even if you've got a government, say, like Greece, where austerity is necessary because it can't fund itself, you've still got to think about where that falls and what the consequences are for your population and how you will deal with what could be a quite severe political backlash. Because I think it's very clear, and we've seen this again and again in history, that austerity policies imposed in a depression on a population that is angry and hurt results in the rise of populist politics and really often and sometimes even fascism. We should be aware of that. We know that happens, and yet we seem to be intent on making the same mistakes again.
On which note, does anybody in the audience want to? Simon Brett.
I think it's Tony Benn that said, I'd rather have a bad parliament than a good king.
You hold it a little closer to your mouth, please.
I think it's Tony Benn that said, I'd rather have a bad parliament than a good king. Now, lots of people, Remainers who I know, said, you know, it's a self-evident truth, the EU is good, the European Commission is good. Is that a bad king? And what are we seeing at the moment? Just a rebellion and a bad parliament.
Can I have another point, please? Anyone? There's a hand up over there.
Sorry, I did raise my hand, but I didn't think I would be called, and we have Brexit. No. Just a couple of observations. Firstly, I would have thought that in the last few years we're not in a neoliberal world. We're in the world of whatever it takes policymaking, and I don't think capital controls is off the table for any central bank anywhere right now. There's tremendous appetite for macro, microprudential, interventionist policies. The second thing is there seems to be a presumption that right-wing hate is hate, but left-wing hate is legit, noble, heroic. And so you have a discourse which is only about binaries, and there's very little space for nuances to say, well, in certain circumstances, austerity is okay, but then you need to do this. There are no but then, there's no space for that sort of conversations. And lastly, just a slightly tongue-in-cheek, I think we should apply bank regulations to politicians. If you had a Volcker rule on excessive risk-taking on the part of politicians, you probably wouldn't be able to call that referendum. If you had the same conduct rules around mis-selling, you probably wouldn't be able to have the kind of campaign that you have. So I think we need a bit more of that kind of regulation on the political process, not just on the markets.
Thank you. Tyler had to leave because he's got to go to a new panel, not because he's sort of walking out in disgust. Can I have some responses to those very interesting points of view? We have about 3 or 4 more minutes. So this is probably closing remarks here.
Well, if I talk a little bit about the EU, since it's been raised, is the EU good? That was basically it, wasn't it?
Is it a good king? I think
is it a
point.
Good king? Yeah. Well, it depends who you talk to and what their perception is. And that is always the problem, because there's no such thing as a wholly good king, is there? Or a wholly bad parliament. They do good things and they do bad things. And it is the balance of perception that determines their fate in the short term and the judgment of history against them in the long term. For me, I think that the EU is a very flawed institution. I really do. I think it has made some massive mistakes, particularly in recent years. I think the way in which it has handled the aftermath of the financial crisis has been dreadful. And it is paying the price for that. And actually, the Brexit vote was very definitely a response to that. The number of people who told me that one of the reasons for their vote was the treatment of Greece. And I can totally understand where they're coming from, because they can see the way in which European creditors responded to Greece and the handling of it by the European Commission, and just think, crikey, if they can do that to them, they can do that to us. And there is a lot of that feeling about it. And I think it would be sensible if the European Union please recognised that actually it is a flawed institution. It does have to change. It needs a radical rethink of all sorts of things, including the free movement of capital, the free movement of people, and the free movement of goods and services.
Which is basically changing it from what it is completely. So
it does have to rethink it. But I think it is overstating it to say that that means it is wholly bad, because there are some things that it's done that I think have been marvellous and terrific, one of which, and the most important thing, and arguably the reason why it was founded in the first place, was the bringing back together of the parts of Europe after the fall of the Iron Curtain. I think it's been a remarkable achievement, and I wish that was celebrated more.
What this reminds me of, very briefly, is Monty Python's Life of Brian. What have the Romans ever done for us? The very last thing they mention is brought peace, which is indeed what the EU has managed to do. Very quickly, before everybody departs. Three of us, your final comments.
At the end of the day, if good economics is not good politics, it's probably not good economics. You really have to think about it.
And
I can add
last
no
word
more. No, I think that was profound, and I don't think I have anything else to say.
Statement.
Okay, I hope you've enjoyed your tea party in the rain. There's a lot more to follow. Thank you very much, everyone.